My name is Clancy Imeslin, and I'm an alcoholic. I feel a little sheepish. I didn't know that we were all supposed to march in from the back in a 10-minute walk to participate. No reason. I feel pretty sheepish just taking a few steps. But I'm very glad to be here tonight. I want to thank Fred and the committee for inviting me to come to Daytona Beach. I've not ever been here before, and I've had a good time looking around and seeing what's going on. I must say that I've had a little bit of a strained week, seriously, and that is because this thing that's going on in Los Angeles started right near the place that I operate downtown Los Angeles, and it was for a while it was nip and tuck down there. And then, of course, it moved west and south, and other buildings burning. I drove home from work Wednesday or Thursday night on both sides of the freeway. There's buildings burning and smoke, and really like a war zone. And Thursday, the brought the National Guard, and on and on. And it was kind of a protest. It started off, I guess, as a protest at the federal building, some people protesting the decision on Rodney King, but it wasn't very long before the protesters were elbowed out of the way by these little pukes who just want to loot and steal, and which is exactly true. They don't know. They didn't even know there's been a court case. They just, well, look at there. There's a Sears store. Come on, Jim. One of the funnier stories I heard, that's not supposed to be very funny, but it seems kind of funny to me, about this guy was in the Kmart. You know what a Kmart is? Big store. And it was on fire. And he had a shopping bag. Some Mexican kid had a shopping cart full of stuff. And he was coming towards the door. The thing was on fire. And he's heading for the door at full speed. And these two big black police officers stopped him. Said, "Hey, freeze! Where are you going?" And the guy said, "Hey man, where's the checker?" That's about the only funny thing about it. But anyway, I really felt a little bad about coming down here on Friday. I thought maybe I should postpone my trip till Saturday, but unfortunately the airlines didn't care about the riot, and I had a non-refundable ticket, and it cost me three times as much to come down the next day, so I told my wife, I said, "I want you to protect the property, do whatever's necessary, fight off these hordes. I'd like to be there myself, but I gotta go down on the beach." I don't know what she said. Something about a hole. But I didn't get a lot of sleep. There's a lot of smoke in the air. I didn't get a lot of sleep Thursday night or Wednesday night. And there's a lot of problems going on. And I had kind of a headache, and I had to get up and catch a plane at 6:30 in the morning, and they couldn't take off because you couldn't take off over the planes could not land over the city because of the smoke and guns going off, so they all coming in over the ocean and taking off over the ocean, and it's just a big mess. We had to wait for a long time, and I flew to Denver, where I just ran across the airport top speed, tired and hot and sick, and caught a plane to Orlando and jumped in the car and drove here, which is all very fine. Except by the time I got here, I had a terrible headache, and I was tired and cross and didn't know what was going on back there. But I tried to act fairly well. I was in line to check in behind a couple new guys, and they were enthusiastic about the thing. And I was back there as a good example, saying, "Hurry up there, for Christ's sake." But I finally got checked in. I wanted to go and hear Joe and Charlie Friday night. I've heard them before, and they look a little different, but they sound the same. They say AA changes us. But I went to bed last night. I went to bed. I really was out of it. And then this morning I got up feeling fairly well, except both my ears were blocked. I couldn't hear and I couldn't do anything. So I had to find it. Drove all over town looking for a clinic today to get it. This guy didn't know. He wasn't exactly an ear specialist. He said, "Here, I'll fix that, some bitch." And he shoved things in my ear and finally got them cleaned up. So I finally got a nap this afternoon, and now I feel wonderful. When it's time to listen to me, I always got time for that. But barring any fires or floods, I'll be here tomorrow morning to judge Joe and Charlie. I've heard them and I've heard their tapes. I heard them in person, and I very much enjoy what they have to say about the big books. I'm a big book fan myself. I don't agree with every interpretation they have, but it's always been my theory, if any two alcoholics ever agreed completely, one of them is lying. Sucking around for some nefarious reason. Yeah, that's right. That's the way you talk to your sponsor, not to real people. But I'm glad to be here. I've had a good time today. Seen some old friends. Saw my old friend John from Syracuse, who pointed out errors in my program, and Mary from Jamaica, who drifting through in the tide, I guess, and Mary Ann from down here, and other people that I've known. But I guess that's about all the personal reminiscences I have at the time. What else was I going to say? Oh, yes. I used to drink. I thought I'd just slide that in somewhere in my story, and now I'll go back to my personal life. And then in 1941, I used to drink, and I spent much of my adult life drinking, like most of us did. I'm sure if you're an alcoholic of my type, if you're not, you're certainly wasting an afternoon and a weekend. You could be home watching reruns of Bowling for Dollars. But if you're an alcoholic of my type, you're glad to be here, and it's a good time, and it's fun to be with people and people like yourself. But I spent a lot of time drinking in my life, but like unlike many people, I never spent a lot of time thinking about my drinking. I guess I've heard people, they seem to say that, oh, yes, and I had to defend my right to drink, and then I had to take this job, but I had to prove I had a right to drink. I never thought that much about drinking. Drinking was just something that was there. My problems were always considerably deeper than drinking. It always seemed to me that there was something unusual about me, and it wasn't a good unusual. It was kind of a cruddy unusual. I've always had the feeling, if I've been given any gift by fate, it's the gift for self-analysis. And I never wanted to waste that gift. So day after day, for year after year, I just examined how I really was, you know. How are you today? I'm feeling pretty good. Let's check that again, shall we? Let me tell you, here's a truism. If you examine yourself every day, I will guarantee you that you will never have a good day. But at the time, it seemed to me I was really making strides. I was deeply into myself and examining things and comparing myself to others and judging and evaluating. And over the years, I've talked a lot about these emotions I've stumbled onto, all kinds of different emotions and strange and peculiar ones I thought at the time. But I would say today they're probably, to save time, I could synthesize them probably into three general areas of emotions. One was a set of emotions that I never identified at the time. I felt it, and it wasn't until I was sober for some time and listening to inventories and talking to people, I began to identify what it was. And it's easy for me to remember it because once in a while I have it today. Any of the emotions I talk about that I used to have, I still have today. It's just that it's considerably diminished and considerably less frequent. But all you have to do is get hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. You want to see how you used to be like? There you are. Just. Well, I do believe they are against me now that I think about it. But the set of emotions that I discovered in retrospect, is for some reason I could not understand. I could feel this, couldn't identify. But I went through life feeling as though there's something about me that is not quite enough. I don't know what it is. I don't have any idea what I'm missing. But other people seem to recognize the fact that I'm not quite enough. And they act as though I'm not quite enough. And they won't, I don't know what it is. I remember a few years ago I was talking at a meeting in Pacific Palisades, and the first speaker was kind of an unschooled, untutored guy. He just kind of, usually they wait a little longer. I mean, it's bad enough Fred went out the back door, but now they're leaving. Come on in here, Fred. We're having a meeting. Take your punishment. But I was in the Pacific Palisades talking, and this guy he was not a smooth speaker. He was not glib, and he was just stumbling around searching for words. And I was, oh God, you know, I was the second speaker. I thought, is this guy going to take up all of his own time? You know, I was hoping he'd leave me 5 or 10 minutes of his anyway. And suddenly I heard him say a sentence that, in a sense, synthesized much of my life. I couldn't have said it myself in 3 hours, is what he said in a sentence. He said, all my life, it seems like people act like there's something different about me, but nobody ever tells me what it is. And boy, I know that feeling. There's just, I'm not quite enough. And the net result of that is that you always have to have something extra going for you. You have to have something extra, some little edge, some little dog and pony show. And there's a corollary to it, too, that I discovered later, that I really can identify with, and that is this. When you don't feel like you're quite enough, you're going through spells where you're not quite enough, and you know that people don't really like you well, but people say they do like you, so without being aware of it, you got to keep testing them. And the test is this. You have to treat me special. If you treat me special, I feel average. If you treat me average, I feel rejected. And I'll tell you, no matter where you go in the world, there's nobody who's going to treat you special all the time. So as a result, after a while, it always looks as though they don't like me anymore. So I've got to move on to new people, new places, new things, new games. You find a new edge. But all my life, it's always seemed like much of my life is that not quite enough, and I don't know what it is. Another thing that has troubled me a lot in my life is it seemed to me, been subject to some terrible waves of fear, and always at just exactly the wrong time. Now I hear people talk about getting afraid and say, boy, I was down and out and I was really afraid. The fear that grabs me comes when I become successful. I worked my buns off and I start to become successful. And all it needs, I never realized it, but in retrospect, all it needs to trigger that fear is somebody criticizing me. Somebody sending a memo. Somebody indicating I'm not doing it right. Something, it might be constructive criticism, but to me, it's an attack. And it's almost instinctively like when you don't feel like you're quite enough and you're holding it together, it's as almost they're on to you. They've discovered I'm not quite enough. I've got to stop them. And so my instinctive reaction again and again has been to try to destroy the person who's doing that. Not with a gun, but with memos and undercutting him and talking about him. Just put him down so he can't get him before he gets me, which is nonsense. And sooner or later, people who act the way I act, you lose your job. And I've done it several times. Big jobs. Another area of my life that has always been a trouble to me is that it always seemed to me, that for some reason I cannot determine, I seem to be more vulnerable to pain than other people are. I know that, you know, no question about it, there are bullets and arrows in the world that have your name on them. And you can't duck them. So I'm not concerned about those. But there seem to be a lot of arrows that are addressed to whom they may concern. And some fool somewhere. And we all got a little coating of armor, and we go through life, and we hear ping, 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 it bounces off. And it just seems to me that much of my life, my armor's been stuck open. And other people say, oh, it's no big deal. Don't pay attention to it. Bullshit. So I'm always feeling something. Always these are about a million other emotions. And all of my adult life, or my late teens and early adult life, I've dealt with these emotions and many other emotions, and they're dreadful. The one compensation I felt I ever had for them is something that I now realize was even more destructive than that. The one thing that I thought was the positive. It always seemed to me, I have a great ambition. I want to be something. I want to be something better than, more than most people I've ever known. I have ambition to be something. At the time, I thought it was a wonderful thing. Now, when I sponsor guys occasionally, I see once in a while I sponsor a guy who has that same intense ambition. And I've learned over the years that it's going to be a long, hard session working with him. Because it is not ambition. It is the It is the compensatory drive of a man who doesn't feel like there's quite enough. I want more and more and more to prove to them that I'm something. It's not ambition. It's a sick compensation. And I'll tell you, there is never enough. There may be enough for a while, but it dies off soon. No new job, the new car, the new woman, the new house, anything. It's all great for a while, but pretty soon it's just normal. You got to find something else. It's always got to be something. So I had a lot of ups and downs in my life. I've spent a lot of my life feeling inferior to people and envying and hating them. I spent a lot of my life feeling superior to people and having contempt for them. The only feeling I never had much, I never felt equal much. Just once in a while going by, I guess. Hold on. So as a relatively young man, I went to psychoanalysis. Now they say, hey, you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. I loved it. I discovered things that would send tears coursing down your cheeks. I remember discovering things like, I was raised in a little town called Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And I've tried to make that stinking town famous. I was raised in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. In something called the Norwegian Lutheran Church. It's not very big anywhere in the world outside of Norway, but it is around northern Wisconsin, Minnesota. And that was the majority church there, like the Southern Baptist is in the south. The Norwegian Lutheran Church was in this little town of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And I was raised in that church, and I loved it. We are the majority. You know, we viewed with suspicion people with dark hair because we knew they were probably not Lutherans. Later, they looked exotic. They really only, as far as I can remember, they only really had two major rules. You don't sin, and you don't monkey with Catholics. Pretty much it, you know. Unfortunately, as I got older, I was weak. I sinned, then I monkeyed with Catholics, and I wound up sinning with Catholics. Practically repopulated the Catholic Church at one time. Until my World War II saltpeter finally kicked in. It's a long wait for that, I'll tell you. I had sex when I was 15, which was unusual for a Norwegian Lutheran, I guess, but I was afraid and I was alone. That's the best little Lutherans can do, I'll tell you. But I knew I was going to hell, but it wasn't the church's fault because I was a sinner. And in psychoanalysis, I was glad to discover that it wasn't my fault. It was the church's fault. They had psychologically scarred me. And I'll tell you, I was really disappointed in that church when I heard that. And I really felt bad about it. To think that my life was screwed up by something that said they were fine, you know. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have hired a couple of codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. I discovered I'd been corrupted and warped by the Depression. I didn't even know there'd been a Depression. But when I found out, I realized I'd been hurt a lot. I've been hurt by a lot of things. And I'll tell you, I noticed over a period of time, one of the things I like about psychoanalysis, I was discovering more and more things that had screwed me around, and yet I was feeling better little by little. And I remember I enjoyed it. I'm kind of sorry when I ran out of dough. Because I can see how people can stay in psychoanalysis 10 years or 20 years. Because it does something that really nobody pays much attention to, And I'd never paid much attention to it. But now in the last few years, there's a whole cult of it, not in psychoanalysis, but in other programs, which bring about something that you don't even recognize. And in this, of course, everything I say is my opinion. I'm required to say that. I secretly feel that I'm talking for Bill and Dr. Bob in heaven. in my opinion, of course. Over the years, I've heard maybe 225 inventories in the last third of a century that I've been active in AA. And there's a lot of things in inventories, but there's a couple things that are, unlike many parts of the country, in Southern California, you take your inventory with your sponsor. That's where you take your inventory. You get it up, because if you can't trust them to listen to your secrets, you really can't trust them to give you direction on your life, we feel. But there's a lot of things that are different. But there's always, in my experience, a couple things that are in every inventory I've ever heard, and of every alcoholic I know around the world who I've known well enough to how they feel. And that people come to AA with us. They may not understand they have it. It may take them a long time to just understand it. But one is lack of self-worth. A lot of people come here thinking they're arrogant and egotistical. Those are defenses against lack of self-worth. If you want to take a person, a newcomer who's egotistical, and you want to get him simmered or what down, build up his self-worth, and the wall comes down. The other thing is something, a deep-seated guilt. And people have different reasons for the guilt, they have different motivations and different, they ascribe it to different things, but the guilt is always there. Now these things are nothing that you can get rid of. There's no phrase to get rid of them. There's no simple little action you can take. These are long-term things you have to work on for a long time in AA. And there's one way to get rid of if you're an alcoholic of my type. One of the reasons to drink alcohol is it temporarily gets rid of all of that stuff. Then you're sober and it comes back. Now, what would you say if I could tell you a way that you could almost instantly get rid of guilt? Impossible to do. But there is a way to do it, and current therapies are doing it. Now, what would that be? What could be provide such magic? It's just this. If I can find a way to prove to myself that it was their fault, then it is no longer my fault. Now, that sounds funny, but it's deadly serious. When it's their fault, I have become a victim. Whatever I have done, the actions I've taken, have been beyond my control because I have been a victim. There's a whole cult of victimization therapies today. And they draw people because they can get rid of guilt. And there's no other way I know of to get rid of guilt quickly than to assume the role of victim. When I'm a victim, it was their fault. There's only one problem for people like you and me. And I'm not judging them at all, but I say in my experience for people like you and me, why the role of victim is not always a good choice. Because it has a price tag. Everything has a price tag. There are no free lunches. Everything that makes you feel better has a price tag. The question is, what's the price? Now that getting rid of guilt does not have a big red price tag on it. It is never on sale. There are three things that have to be present in order for me to sustain the absence of guilt. One, I must continue to reinforce and sustain my resentment of those people who have done this to me. And we gather once a week to talk about how bad they were. I must reinforce and sustain my feelings of self-pity because I could have been something if they hadn't ruined my life. And thirdly, I have to reinforce and sustain my feelings of difference because I would have fit in if they hadn't screwed up my life. Look what they have done to me, either back then or now. And if you'll ever, as you'll discover if you listen to Joe and Charlie, or in your reading of the book, if it gets that bad, the three things that are most lethal for people like you and me are resentment, self-pity, and feelings of difference. So that really is an expensive price you pay to temporarily get rid of guilt. That is why people in these therapies, there's an old joke about it, I'm not judging it, but they say people in those therapies never leave their meeting smiling, because that's not the purpose of their meeting. We leave our meeting smiling many times, but they don't, because they must reinforce and sustain these feelings to continue to remove the guilt. Now, as you may have gathered in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have no opinion on what they do, and we really don't. I have no opinion on ACOA. I have no opinion on the inner child therapy. Whatever they do, I wish them well. I hope their meetings are full, and I hope people want that. They want it. But I'll tell you this. I don't want to come to an AA meeting and hear that crap being talked about here. I do not go to inner child meetings and insist they work the 12 steps. And I don't want them coming to me and telling me about their bruised inner child. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of recovery. We talk about what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. And is the only thing that has ever been successful, people like you and me, has been mentioned, 53 years, that book has changed more alcoholic lives than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. And while and yet people who don't understand that come here and they find this kind of simple stuff and they'd prefer to tell about what their counselor taught them in treatment. And I have no opinion on treatment either, except that I don't want to hear about it in AA. AA is AA. That's exactly what it is. And if you're in a closed meeting where non-alcoholics are participating, it seems to me your job as a traditional AA is to say, I'm sorry, but this is a closed meeting. People may not always like you, but that's what AA is about. And if they start taking your meeting and talking about outside issues and what their parents have done to them and how they've worked, their lives are worked, let's talk about getting better. Now, don't misunderstand me. I know that a lot of us come here with a lot of scars. I did, and you did. But it is my belief that Alcoholics Anonymous, if practiced over a period of time, like it says the young lady read tonight at the end of the promises, these promises will come true if you work at it. As was read in chapter 5 tonight. This is one of the lines we've heard so many times we forget what it means. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, not reading them, not discussing them, not evaluating them, but doing them over a period of time. That's what brings about a change. Probably the most difficult relationship I had in my life was my father. He was not an alcoholic. He was, to the world, a good man, a fine man. He was a long-term teacher in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. He was like the Mr. Chips. Everybody in town had him. I still go back there, and guys 80 years old say, boy, your dad was sure good. He was my favorite teacher back in 1931 or whatever it might be. Really was great. And my father was my idol, and I loved him, and he was so talented and clever and fun and played the piano and sang and directed and run the school paper. And in the 1930s, I just adored him. As I got older, he seemed to get more distant and aloof and seemed to be more judgmental of me and more didn't seem to like me as well. Then in 1940, about 41, much to my surprise, I was just a boy. My mother and father got divorced. And I'll tell you what kind of insulated life I had. I had never seen a divorce till my parents got a divorce. I'd never heard of one. Nobody, I never knew I'd ever had one. I'd heard the phrase, I guess. And I couldn't believe it. And pretty soon he had remarried a woman who I hated. And my mother remarried a man who I hated. And I just felt terrible. I just felt terribly betrayed. And I would live with one and then with the other and then my grandmother. And the war started. 15 years old, I ran away from home. I ran away from home, ran to sea. I spent my 16th birthday in Pearl Harbor early in the Second World War. Dumb little short kid with pimples in his face, but they didn't check you very closely then. You just went in. And I always had such a terrible feeling of love and resentment for my father for ruining my life. After the war, at the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital up in Northern California, and the Red Cross passed out a bunch of tests. I was glad to say that. So I was able to take a test that enabled me to get a high school equivalency. because I'm still a junior in high school. I don't know what I'd have done if I had to go back after the war and go to high school. I wouldn't have done it. But I was able to go to college. I was in the first class of veterans after the war. And we all stood around on street corners and tried to look like steely-eyed, sex-crazed killers, wondering if our unemployment check would come on time. And I got married in college, and because that's what veterans did. And my father just seemed to be distant. Then I married this Catholic girl, and he seemed to be even more distant. He just seemed... And he and his wife, I hated his wife, and he just didn't seem to care for me. He didn't care for my children, and he didn't care for anything, and I just hated him. But I loved him, and I wanted so much to him to like me, and he didn't seem to like me. 1950 came the fruition of all of this. I was drinking heavily now, and I was roistering and getting in little street fights, and no big deal, but I was still doing rather well. And one, night I got out in a bar somewhere and some guy got in a fight over a sports event, for Christ's sake, and turned out he was a cop and he had me arrested. So I spent all night in jail. About the third night I'd been in jail, no big deal, but the next morning at 6 o'clock my father came down to my jail cell. Now, he had never done that before. I thought, well, maybe we're going to get back together. Maybe this is what it took to encourage him. And he said, son, did you have a good time last night? I said, no, Dad, I really didn't. It was just a dumb thing. It won't happen again. Just, I can't tell you how dumb it was. And I was really so glad to see him. He said, I hope you had a good time, because while you're out drunk, you let your little son die. I don't ever want to see you again. And away he went. I remember hollering after him, I didn't mean to! That isn't much to holler. That's all you got. I was just about crazy. I loved that little boy. And a couple, 3 days later, there was a funeral. Relatives came from far and near, as they always do, and I really hadn't let him die. He'd got sick in the night and died. But if I'd have been there, would have changed it. But we all knew it was my fault. I knew it. They all sat in the funeral and around the house afterwards, as they do, you know. Nobody said an unkind word to me, and they smiled at me. But I could just see in their eyes, you dirty son of a bitch. And I just, and my father especially, I thought, God damn you, you will never see me again. You'll never touch me again. One time I needed something and you give me nothing. Go back to your stinking old wife and have a good time. And that was the end of my father. And now jump ahead a few years. And I was sober about 8 months. And I'd taken my inventory. And one day my sponsor, this didactic, cruel man, said, well, now that you've written your inventory, time to make amends. He said, I want you to make a list of people you harmed, but I know one you want to start with right now. I'm going to make an amend to your father. And I said, what? That guy has ruined my life. He had a big spot in my inventory, I'll tell you. He has ruined my life. He's ruined my mother's life. He's ruined everybody's life. Everybody thinks he's such a nice man. He's a rotten man. He destroyed me. And he said, well, that may be true, kid. He must have been a crappy father. But I'll tell you something. You're a crappy son, too. We don't care what he does, because that's his problem. But we're going to make you get better. You're going to write a letter and tell him that you're sorry you hurt him. And then he said the operative words that just killed me, but I've said them ever since. He said, and bring me the letter before you send it. I've read a lot of amends letters, I'll tell you. I want you to know I'm sorry, you dirty bastard. You know. And I showed him my letter. I said, no, this is an attack. You're supposed to write a letter of amend. And it took me about 3 letters till I finally got one done. And he said, okay, send it. So I sent it. My father sent back a note. He said, well, I'm glad you're doing well, son. I hope you're all right. And he said, now I want you to send him a birthday card. Now send him a Christmas card. Send him a little present. I don't want him. I don't mind with my mother because I love her. But damn it, this went on. And I resented it, and I hated it. He's telling me little notes of what was going on in Eau Claire. I didn't even care. I'd read them, and I'd throw them down. When I was about 3 or 4 years sober, 3 years, I guess, I had a little job, and I had to go to Minneapolis to do some work. And I told my mother I'd come to Eau Claire to see her, because I was sober and doing well now. And My sponsor said, "While you're down there, I want you to visit your father." So, "I don't want to visit my father and that stinking bitch he's married to." He said, "Well, we don't care what you want." So I went down, saw my mother, spent half a day with her, and saved myself about 10 minutes with my father. I went over to his house, and I just hated to go there. I pressed the doorbell, I almost ran. And he opened the door, and this big, intimidating guy. He was a small, nice man. He said, "Well, son, I'm glad to see you. I hope you're all right. Come on in." I hesitated. He said, "Well, my wife knows how you feel, so she's gone. You can come in." So I came in. I said, "Did you bring enough for everyone?" And I said, "My father and I talked briefly, and I wanted to get out of there in the worst way, and I did. We talked briefly, but I just knew he was just being hypocritical." And the next year, I was back there for another reason. I went down and saw him again, and she was gone, being hypocritical. But it was easier to write the notes once in a while now, and the letters, but I wasn't, not no letters, cards and gifts and so on. And when I was 5 years sober, thank you, my wife and children returned to me. They were living in a post office box in Dallas. And they moved out to the West Coast. I was really doing quite well, actually. I had a pretty good deal going. I could go to meetings and talk and say, "Well, I've lost my wife and children, but I'm living alone now. But I'll be all right." "Would you like to be my new mother?" I didn't say that, but some people got that impression for some reason. Well, anyway, my wife and children and I reunited, and they moved out to California. And I'll tell you what a culture shock that was. I was sober 5 years now. Now, we had been separated several times, and every time I was doing well in a couple cities, but when they moved in, I'd get drunk. I couldn't stand the pressure. Here they come now. All these kids, I love them all, and dogs and cats and... And pretty soon I'm like in the yellow submarine, just noise. Aren't you ever going to stop selling those goddamn tickets? Anyway. They don't let up easily around here, I'll tell you. I've got mine on the table there, Fred. Okay, well, that's the end of my talk, folks.
I don't know, but the people in Daytona, you know, this hotel next door had a lot of cars hauled away last week, and about to do the same thing tonight. They own those two parking lots across the street, and they are allowing us to park in those, but do not park in front of the carnival or that timeshare unit next door.
Well, one of the sad things about a memorized talk is once you lose your place, you got to start over. My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Fred and the committee for... But anyway, they moved, and I was, you know, and not only that, but I'd go to meetings trying to get a little sympathy. I'd say, "Geez, my family's there. They're just all filling..." "Oh, that's wonderful for you. No more sadness and loneliness for you, huh?" And I got a call from my father. He said, "Son, I don't hate to bother you," he said, "but my wife suddenly died from a heart attack. Val suddenly died. And I don't have anybody. Could you come and see me through this?" And I'll tell you, at that stage, I very likely would have found a reason not to go, because I was busy and I had a new job and I didn't want to go. But I could get away from the yellow submarine for a few days and evaluate where I was. So I said, "Sure." So I went to Eau Claire. And I walked him to the funeral, and I acted like a responsible person. And about a night or two afterwards, we were sitting after the night of the funeral. We sat up and got talking and talked all night. And I told him how I felt a little bit, but he was telling me how it looked to him. And I'll tell you, it staggered me. Our relationship looked 180 degrees from the way it looked to me. All he remembered, and I'm sure it was correct, is that he all His hopes and dreams were centered in me. As I was a little boy, I seemed to get more and more sassy and a little more independent and a little more resentful. He wanted me to be something, and I just... Then he and my mother had come to a separation by universal agreement. And he met this other woman, and they got married, and it seemed that everything I talked to him was always an accusation. I was snotty and nasty, and it broke his heart. And he finally backed off a little bit because he couldn't stand the way I was acting all the time and killing him. And after the war, it was the same way. And he felt so bad because he felt I didn't care about anything. I was just a heedless, self-willed, nasty thing, and let my son die and didn't even care, and he couldn't stand the pain of watching me be destroyed. And you know, I never thought of him that way. All I saw was he had left me, and I had left him. But anyway, before the night was over, we cried together. And from then on, my father and I, little by little, had a relationship. I would say for the next 20 years, my father and I were closer than any father and son I knew. And in his declining years, he moved out to our house in Los Angeles and lived there. And just when he was about to die, he, like an old elephant, wanted to go back to the elephant burial ground. So we went back to Eau Claire, and he was in the hospital there for a while. And then he died. Touched my hand, I touched his hand, he died with a smile. And a couple of days later, I remember sitting in the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, my father's little casket, hall about this big, really, and looking around full of old family friends, old Norwegians, and I was glad my father had died because he'd been so sick and in pain. And I was thinking to myself, I'm so lucky that I was an alcoholic and driven to this. Because of that, I discovered the same God is in this church as is in my meeting in West Los Angeles. There isn't a Norwegian hateful God here and a loving God there. It's all God. And I looked around those people, these old Norwegians, they sat in that church. Good people, but they've spent their lives in fear of that hateful God, and they'll never overcome it. Till they die, they'll live in that fear of that hateful God. And that I am so glad, and all I have left is memories of my father that are pleasant and good because I took the steps of AA over a long period of time doing things I didn't want to do. That's another reason to have a good, strong sponsor, I suppose. Without my sponsor, I never would have done it. But the point of this story is, if I'd have gone for the quick fix, absence of guilt, where my life problems were caused by him, to this day, every time I heard his name, my stomach would churn and grind, and I'd think, that dirty son of a bitch. Look what he did to me. I never would have had a father in my whole life, living or dead. And that's too big a tab to pay to get rid of instant guilt. And all I'm saying to you, if you are like me, try to avoid victimization because the price tag is too big for it. Alcoholics Anonymous teaches us something else, that no matter what's happened to us or how we got here, we work on it and we identify it and we look at it, but the time has to come when finally you must say, but that was then and this is now. And I'm going to live my life with some dignity and not spend the rest of my life in the role of a 17-year-old neurotic kid. I want to live with dignity. That's what AA allows us to do, but it's such a siren song. We can rid you of guilt. Look what they did to you. And it's lethal. But anyway, I got a psychoanalysis and I found a lot of that stuff and I loved it. I kept me in the victimization role for years. I got into metaphysics. I got into a lot of things. But the one thing that helped me the most my whole life, something I never paid any attention to, when I was 15 years old on the deck of a ship in Pearl Harbor, some men intimidated me into drinking some whiskey. And I hated it, and it made me throw up. And the next day I tried to drink some more to impress them, and I threw up. And I'd promised my mother I'd never drink. I didn't care. I had to impress them. And I'd sneak into their bottle and take a drink. Finally, one day, I held a drink down. And that day I discovered that alcohol served a very positive function in my life. It made me feel significantly better almost instantly. And I thought, I'm sure glad to understand that. It's good stuff. Because, you know, I didn't pay much attention. You learn all you learn most of your life. You learn most in your teens. You learn about drinking. You learn about sex. You learn about work. You learn about human relationships. You learn about love. You learn about all sorts of things. And you try to find ways to handle them well. And drinking was something that... No big deal. It was just one of the positive things I found, so it made me feel significantly better. And I got drunk sometimes, but I didn't become a stumbling old drunk. I liked it, had a lot of fun with it, made me feel grown up when I drank. And after the war, I went to college, and I drank my way through college. That's what we did. At the end of the, when I got out of college, I went to work as a sports writer in newspapers. And I had married this Catholic girl who, nobody ever told me about this, but if you marry a good Catholic girl, you become the head of a large family, whether you want one or not. I used to plead with her, can't we use birth control? Say no. She had a priest come by one day and give me about an hour and a half on the rhythm system, which is the Catholic version of birth control. I listened intently, just couldn't pick up that beat. So I became a national distributor of small Catholics, you know. And I drank too much, and sometimes I drank too much, but I had good times and bad times. And the only problem I ever had was drinking. Drinking enabled me to do things that I never could have done to myself. It enabled me to talk, to be vivacious. Except myself, I'm not quite enough. But drinking, I discovered, and I know in retrospect what it did, it took a person who didn't feel like they were quite enough and made them feel something more than enough. It took a person subject to fear and made me momentarily omnipotent. It took a person highly vulnerable and made me invulnerable. Drinking is the best friend I ever had. That sounds terrible to say that at an AA meeting. You know, but it still bothers me when I hear people get up and say, that damn alcohol! There's poison from the very first drink. It's like hearing somebody badmouth an old girlfriend of mine, you know. Hey, just a minute. She may be a pig now, but she didn't used to be. You know. The only problem I ever had with drinking, I have an unfortunate tendency to drink a little too much sometimes. And sometimes I've become bizarre. That word was used with a monotonous regularity. Why, you're bizarre. It took me a while to understand why that was. But I found out in psychoanalysis, I put it all together. I was like a spring. Instead of being allowed to flourish, when I was a young man, I was victimized by these various forces and my spring was kept coiled. And now alcohol has released these bounds and made sense to me. The cops never bought it, but I loved it. So I was sent to my first AA meeting when I was 22 years old, 1949. That's a long time ago, before some of you little snots were born. We love you. Now, 22 isn't terribly young in AA now. We're going to have an icky paw meeting tonight. Dance. One of the longest announcements I ever heard, I'll tell you that. They're cutting into my time there. But I want to say this. At that time, nobody had heard of anybody with 22. That was 15 years younger than anybody. So they just thought I was a little freak, and I thought they were old freaks. And there's something I've been saying a lot the last few months, because I think it needs to be said. So often now, we take the young people for granted. We have young people throughout the hall. And you were in my home group, the Pacific group. Some of you have been there. Oh, stop it. This is the sign for applause, Mary. Huh? Oh, I guess I got it mixed up. Anyway, Pacific Group has about 1,200 people meet every Wednesday night. You can imagine 2.5 times this. Every Wednesday night in this big synagogue, some of you have been there, know it's true, and excitement, and a lot of young people. And I want you to know, you young people here tonight, if you are like the young people in our group, I want to remind you, you are the AA leaders of tomorrow. And if you're like the young people in our group, I want to tell you something. I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. I really am glad I'm going to be dead. I'm just happy about it. Nothing personal. I'll give you a little hope. My sponsor told me that 30 years ago, and he's glad he's dead, so. But anyway, I went to AA, and then AA is a nice place, but AA is designed for people unlike me. It's designed for people who have problems with drinking, and they get sober, and they clean up their act, and their life gets better, and they live happily ever after. And I could realize that would be the case if my problem were drinking. But what I drink for is to soften the problems I feel. So drinking is not really my problem. And then I got into psychoanalysis and metaphysics and read a lot of books. And from time to time, when I got in drinking problems, because I drank too much sometimes, and I'd go to AA again. But AA is a nice place, but it is not designed for me because I don't fit their category for the problem. Now I'll jump ahead to, I became successful sometimes, and I'd drink too much and get in trouble, emotional problems, respond, act, oh, drink, lived in different cities. So the day finally came that cannot happen to a person with my background and intelligence. Well, go ahead and laugh. You have no idea what it's like. Anyway, I don't know why I'm never invited back anywhere. I try to be nice. But anyway, I found myself one day being thrown out of a Skid Row mission. And the guy said, and stay out of here, you drunken bum. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that some other guys and I helped write, the old Elsie and Elmer ads for the board company, if you remember, old enough to remember them. They were running that very week. Ads that I worked on were running in Time and Life and Collier's and Daily Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair, you know. Several weeks before that, I had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank, so I wasn't hitting those consonants quite as clean. And I stood outside of a Skid Row mission at 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning. The cold rain falling, I'll tell you. Everything was gone. If a guy had come up to me and said, pal, your life depends on the answer. Are you an alcoholic? Maybe that's it. I'd say, no, I'm not, but I wish I were. I wish my life were that simple. I wish I could stop drinking and clean up my act and live happily ever after. But there's something a lot deeper than that. And I've spent thousands of dollars and years of my life to find out what. And I wish these little simple therapies could help, but not really. It was raining, so I walked 71 blocks out to a corner of Wilshire and Fairfax for a little AA club that I'd been asked to leave a week before for fighting in there and raising hell. I hung around that club and for days, and I had no place to sleep. There was an abandoned car down at the end of the parking lot, an old Mercury, and I lived in that. And I hung around that club, and the club was a bad place to me for one great reason. It was one of those places full of AA fanatics. There's nothing quite as depressing when you're intelligent and having a bad run is to run across an AA, because they're meaningless nincompoops. I just don't know what to do. Well, Rick, go to a lot of meetings, break the steps. I am. And you go to meetings and you hear that. They have a lot of speaker meetings in California, Los Angeles. God, it gets so sickening when you're down and out and you hear some other fool get up and say, friends, I stayed drunk round the clock for 25 years. One day I walked through that door. The desire to drink left me instantly. I now have $3 million with me tonight. Several different families have returned to me. No, all the one thing, I put the plug in the jug. And I feel wonderful. And when you're sitting there just suicidally depressed, you just remember thinking, I wish I had one curare dart. Just one, just tell us how that feels, you old sumbitch. I really don't suppose I ever felt any worse in my life in those weeks I was hanging around there. And I don't know if you... I was in the Texas Insane Asylum in the mid-1950s because I was in there as a successful suicide. I tried to stay sober. I felt so bad about... Somebody triggered my feelings about my dead son, and I had another baby coming. I didn't want anything to happen to that baby, so I stayed sober no matter what happened. And one day it got so bad I couldn't stand it. And finally, when my wife and kids were at church, I just went to God's and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. And the neighbor watched this and saw me not come out of the garage, so he pulled me out and got my heart started and put me in the hospital, in state hospital. And that was that's what happens to me when I stay sober too long. True story. True story. And so I really was not thrilled by all this crap. Well, stay sober. Just gets better and better. Or gooder and gooder. I thought, what I really thought, I remember thinking this, it may sound funny, but briefly I thought, I wonder if my suicide in Texas really was successful. And this is what hell is like. Just to go like this through eternity. Just, Jesus Christ. Surrounded by nincompoops and fools and just... And they did the same thing then and they do now. They say things like, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. So there was a guy, an actor, character actor, who used to come to AA that club, and I asked him to be my sponsor. I thought he'd be up to my standards. And he always played loving roles in the movies, and I thought he'd be loving and kind. And he should have won the Academy Award for every one of those roles. He was a nasty, cruel, didactic, mean, intimidating person. Sick. I don't care what you think, just do what I tell you. No. And he wouldn't listen to me. I tried to reason with him. Bob, you know, you've been my sponsor a while now. I don't think you understand, Bob. I'm not one of these guys who just walked in AA with a drink around. I've been to AA for years, a lot more than you have. I've been in psychoanalysis. I've had top men working my problems, and this action you talk about is very nice, but it's not enough for people with the intensity of my emotions. In my judgment, Bob, I need something much more than this. And he'd say things like, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. No. Yeah, that's right. And I'll think later, what kind of answer is that, for Christ's sake? Well, I tried it. He'd have me do dumb things. Pick up the cups. Care about them. I'd disappear right in the woodwork. I was out of there before he finished the sentence. Set up the chair. Yeah, I'll be there early on. Yeah, sure, you bet. Thank the speaker. Sure I will. Screw you, speaker. You know, it's bad enough for it to be intelligent and down, but then to have your face rubbed in it, that's just a little too much. Well, this went on. A guy took me on his sofa for a couple of weeks, and his wife got upset because I was putting out cigarettes on the rug under the sofa. Well, otherwise I'd had to walk across the room to an ashtray. I went back to my abandoned car. Another guy put me on the sofa, and I did all